Today, we're privileged to host a distinguished University of Tennessee alumnus, Dr. Lee Hunter, a highly experienced and board-certified orthopedic surgeon, currently also working as a consultant for Arthrex, and a longstanding practicing orthopedic surgeon with the Tennessee Orthopedic Alliance. Dr. Hunter also holds an MBA from UT's Haslam College of Business. His expertise spans medical devices, surgery, and commercialization. Dr. Hunter is the founder and CEO of Hunter Med LLC, where he developed not only his innovative elbow lock system, but also a device to help with the surgery of the trigger fingers in his office setting. Get ready to gain some great insights from a UT alum who's a true leader in orthopedics and medical innovation. He also shares his reason for pursuing an MBA at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and how his organizational action plan was foundational for the success he has had at Hunter Med LLC.
Welcome to PEMBA On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. PEMBA On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of different healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare, career development, and healthcare leadership. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional or legal advice. The views and opinions expressed by me, the host, or guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization we are affiliated with.
Welcome to PEMBA On Demand. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Norm.
I've been looking forward to our conversation for quite some time now, and I was fascinated by when we were prepping for this show, just to learn a little bit about your evolution and your journey, I guess, not only as orthopedic surgeon, but also in the medical device industry. And I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about your company, Hunter Medical, and what it produces and how you got interested in medical devices and a little bit about your journey from clinician to entrepreneur and in the medical device world.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Thanks, Norm. And I appreciate your time. Thanks for the opportunity to share my story with you. So I went to undergrad at Vanderbilt University. I was actually an anthropology major and a chemistry minor. There are a few of us out there. And anyway, I went to med school at University of Tennessee down in Memphis. And then I did my residency at the Campbell Clinic, also in Memphis. And then I graduated, of course, I went out to work, and I've been with what used to be called Mid-Tennessee Bone and Joint Clinic. We actually merged with Tennessee Orthopedic Alliance, a really large organization, back about 4 years or so, I guess, now. And it's a large orthopedic organization, of course, in Tennessee, and we're a division-type model, if you will, where I'm in the Columbia, Tennessee division. We're a 12-surgeon group. I'm the hand and elbow surgeon. And then there's Tennessee Orthopedics Nashville, and also Tennessee Orthopedics East Tennessee, which is based in Knoxville, but has a lot of satellite offices. But kind of how I stumbled into the medical device world when I was a resident, trained at a big trauma center, the regional medical center in Memphis, and we did lots and lots of course, trauma work, did a lot of elbows. As we started, of course, we were residents, and we were kind of clumsy and probably not real good at a lot of things back then, but learning. And it struck me that doing elbow fractures, just positioning the elbow appropriately to make the operation easier always seemed to be a struggle. So as time went by, I actually thought industry would solve my problem. When I came out of residency and fellowship, I did a lot of elbow fractures, and it always seemed to be just difficult to get the arm exactly right to make the case easier. And I've been out 2 or 3 years, I guess, and I drew some little things on the back of a napkin. Maybe this might work, and put it in a drawer and work the next decade, and came back and then really kind of put pen to paper and started working on it. I was really looking for just a simple positioner that I could position the patient supine and hold the elbow vertically across the chest, stable with good access to it where I could manipulate the arm during the surgery. That's really all I was after. And as time went by, it morphed into some other things. But when I finally got serious about it, I went down to my local, a friend of mine in town had a machine shop, and he cut me some, basically a few parts that I put together, and I did a couple of elbow fractures with it. We autoclaved it in our surgery center and met the sterilization criteria and all that. And it was kind of a proof of concept model almost right out of the box. So I did a couple of fractures with that little very rough design. And then I started doing elbow arthroscopy, also supine with this rough design. And then I went and shopped it around, kind of the concept, and ended up signing no one was interested in it. I was a total voice in the wilderness, right? And this was back about 2009, I guess, actually, right when I got out of Pemba. And I signed a licensing agreement with a very small company. And they took my design and created something that worked okay for a very few selected elbow operations, certainly better than anything I'd seen before. And that licensing agreement stayed in effect for about a year, year and a half, until the company kind of imploded. And they sold a few of the devices, but it was big and clunky and kind of cumbersome and not real versatile. So it would have never made it prime time. So that brings us to about 2010, maybe something like that. And then I took everything I learned from that experience and I rescinded the licensing agreement. We negotiated that. And then I started developing something really kind of totally different based on that original design. And basically at the end of the day, I ended up with a device called the Elbow Lock, which is basically a 4-in-1 upper extremity positioning system. And it allows you to do anything that you need to do for an arm, really from, say, the deltoid tuberosity, proximal third junction of the humerus, to the fingertips. And it allowed me to do supine elbow arthroscopy and fracture work, which was really what I was after all along. And I threw a lateral positioner component in with it, and then I actually ended up stacking a wrist tower on top of that. So I ended up with this tray that will fit in any standard autoclave in the United States that'll latch onto any Clark Rail OR table over sterile drapes. And it was, I think, seven components that you'd assemble together based on what you're trying to do to the arm. It had sterile field kits and sterile finger traps that are sold separately. And basically time went by and we formed a company back around, I guess, 2012. I went to my first trade show, which was the Orthopedic Trauma Association, I think 2014. Sold a few and we built it up. Me, and I had one employee and I had a minor investor, but we built it off all guerrilla marketing. Between 14, I think around maybe 18 is when I bolted the wrist tower attachments onto it as well. So it did kind of evolve over time, but the concept was still a multifunctional tool, unique tool for arm surgery, really. Well, not for elbow surgery, really just for humerus, elbow, forearm, and hand, that would be everything the arm surgeon would ever need, with disposable finger traps and disposable field kits for all the procedures. And basically, through a series of trade shows and connections, I built a connection list, an email contact list of about 7,000 surgeons focused on the upper extremity. And I sold the IP associated with that device to Arthrex in this winter of 22.
So it sounds like you began working on this process, at least the back of the napkin drawings, somewhere in the early 2000s. And then between then and 2022, you got it to the point where someone actually purchased the intellectual property. And I assume then that they have been producing it, manufacturing it since that time?
Yes. Yeah. Of course, they're a large company and they had to put it through different quality metrics. So it took quality processes and internal validation processes and things like that. So they actually formally launched it, I guess, in this past fall.
Okay.
They did a little bit of retooling to it, but they formally launched it this last fall and they're selling it like hotcakes. They've got a much bigger megaphone than I had. But it's interesting. I loved it. First time I had epiphany when I really figured out how to make it applicable to any body habitus, because it had to fit in an autoclave, right? Because I wanted everything sterile.
Yep.
Yeah. Big people, tall people, so forth. Lots of variability.
Yeah.
When I figured that out, I woke up one morning, do a bunch of sketches, and I thought, I'm going to sell this thing next month. And of course, took me about 6 or 8 years, and we got some academic guys liking it. And when I hit, I think 8,500 procedures with it, 8,500 mm-hmm. surgeries, field kits sold, that's when people started knocking on the door.
So what was the process of positioning for these types of injuries before you developed this tool?
Some surgeons would position the patient lateral, like support them on a beanbag, turn them lateral, inflate the beanbag, pad them, and have their arm kind of dropped over the table with their elbow kind of sticking up. But mm-hmm. to me, that was honestly 30 to 45 minutes of just wasted effort. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do everything supine with the arm across the chest. And there are still people that do elbow fractures, elbow arthroscopy lateral. But I would say 10 years from now, they won't. I think mm-hmm. they'll all be using the device, this device we're speaking of, or something very similar to it. Because I did a study of, I think I did 30 elbow scopes lateral and 30 elbow scopes supine while I was transitioning. And it was about a 42-minute time savings on just the positioning. So it's incredibly more efficient. It's less anesthesia for the patient, less OR time, same procedure, same outcome. It just checks all the boxes with what we're all trying to do, right? Do a better job faster, better for the patient. Supine has fewer positioning palsies than lateral mm-hmm. or any other type of positioning does. Less general anesthetic, better airway access.
Yeah.
It's just so logical. But for years, I really felt like kind of a voice in the wilderness. But then I met a sale or two, and then it just really started kind of taking off. But I never gave up my day job. I just took a morning off a week and had a wife that was understanding and just kind of worked through it.
How did you get the hospital administration or the OR leadership to allow you to bring in your first prototype into the OR?
Well, it wasn't a hospital system. It was a freestanding ASC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was kind of rough pieces, but they threw the indicators in. We just processed it like we normally would. It was stainless steel, and showed it to our IRB or whatever you'd like to call it, and they approved it. And I talked to the patient. I talked to them, said, hey, I've got this big chunk of metal that I'm going to bolt on the table. It's sterile. The drapes are sterile, but I think it helps me do your surgery better. So are you okay? I was very open with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then after I did, I don't know, 10 or 15 with it, it became so obvious that this thing has legs and it's going to work. One thing kind of led to another after that.
Well, so do you think that being in a freestanding surgery center did help you get it tested in a clinical scenario sooner than if you had been trying to do that in a hospital that was part of a hospital system or even an independent hospital?
It certainly saved me time because mm-hmm. it's my surgery center, our group practices in it. We've got like a dozen partners and a few eye surgeons and a couple of pain guys. And I just told them what I was going to do. And to run that through a formal hospital system, maybe I could have got it done, but it would have taken months and months. Yeah. Our surgery committee meeting meets on the third Tuesday of every other month, so we'll discuss it then. And it would, maybe I could have done it, but it would have certainly been more difficult.
So what do you think about where the pendulum is right now in terms of regulation, the FDA, and the impact on how quickly we can innovate in medicine compared to what it was 30 or 40 years ago?
The FDA is, it certainly has a purpose to serve, but if you've ever tried to accomplish anything from a corporate standpoint on the FDA website, to me, my wife and I try to do it, and we finally just end up having to pay an FDA consultant just to get mm-hmm. it, wade us through the cumbersome website just to get our FDA registration. But it's expensive. I think we were paying $9,000 a year, something like that. Between $6,000 and $9,000 a year just to be registered, just to have a device registered, which for a micro company like we were at the time, I really kind of thought that was kind of ridiculous, but that's what it was. I was fortunate in many ways as far as I went down the path of mine's low tech, like really low tech, right? Steel components that fit together, and while they look sleek and it's extremely effective and it works really, really well for arm surgeons, It was a class, I think it was a class one. Yeah, it was a class one medical device. So that made it easier. It wasn't a needle. It wasn't an injection. It wasn't an implant that I was leaving in the patient. So the development process was quite a bit easier. I had a consultant help me with the 510K. So that was less onerous than I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. We ended up getting seven patents issued. And that process, patent attorneys are not cheap. And that was quite eye-opening. But yeah, the FDA, it was anybody who's been through it will tell you it was more of a hassle than certainly I thought it would be. And the website, surely they'll the friendliness of that soon.
Yeah.
But that was all I can suggest is get a consultant that was reasonable and responsive and good to work with and take it from there, because it's a jungle or was back in the day.
So given the fact that all of the complications being as frequent as they were with the types of positioning, and the one that strikes me from my background in emergency medicine, of course, is the desire to have access to airway rescue maneuvers when you're sedating someone in the emergency room. Why do you think it took until 2008, 2009 for someone to come up with an idea, a viable product to solve this problem?
That's a great question. And largely, I think it's because back in the day when people started doing elbow arthroscopy and started doing like distal humerus fractures and things of that nature, they tried to find a way to make the humerus stable, because the humerus kind of sits on the shoulder and it's really kind of a mortar and pestle type situation. So you have to find some way to stabilize the humerus just to create kind of a stable platform for the elbow. So somebody figured out if you put them lateral, decubitus, and you put like a bolster under the arm and hang the elbow off the side, the humerus is kind of stable. And generations of orthopedic surgeons were trained that way. And that really never changed. Some people, every now and then I'd run across someone, and I saw this performed a couple of times in surgery, where in training, where you'd put a covered Mayo stand, bring it from the other side of the patient across their chest and just lay their elbow on that. And you could kind of halfway statically hold the elbow still. But I don't know that really, honestly, much thought was spent putting into a device where you could have complete dynamic and static control of the elbow. So you can move the elbow freely with it throughout the case, and then you can lock it in whatever position you'd want, really with just like the one hand. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was really even, maybe it was thought of, but I'd never seen anything like it until I kind of ended up designing what I had.
So I want to ask you some questions. You mentioned you were an anthropology major and a chemistry major in undergraduate school, but as a kid, did you have an aptitude for inventing or tinkering with devices, that type of thing? When did you realize that being able to take a concept that you've, an abstract concept in your head, and put it on a piece of paper and then see it as a 3D thing and walk into a machine shop and say, hey, I want you to build me this. Where did that skill come from? And when did you realize that that was an aptitude that you had?
I'm not really sure. It certainly wasn't in any of my anthropology classes. But when I was a kid, I liked tractor work. I grew up in a little small town, and we did a lot of tractor and farm work. So I always liked kind of tinkering with things.
Okay.
And then when I went to med school in there, and I like, at the end of the day, I went there thinking I was going to be a CV surgeon, but then I ended up really just kind of, I enjoyed radiology, and then I really liked anatomy, and I really liked orthopedics. So I went to orthopedics, and then I realized, wow, you guys have all these great toys to play with. So then that's really when I started doodling or sketching, if you will.
Okay.
In surgery, I got in the habit of, as part of the kind of the pre-op explanation of the patient, kind of drawing sketches. Okay, this is what this is going to look like. And it just kind of went from there.
Gotcha.
And then once you get into it, and I still really enjoy it. Some days when the just sketching things and sketching the concept and seeing it come to life, it was at times a painful, but in retrospect, it's been a really, really worthwhile journey. And now when I walk in and see this global orthopedics company with their logo on my device in an OR in Florida or whatever, now that's really cool.
I'm sure that's very professionally satisfying, right? To see something have the impact across the country like this?
Well, you see, there's so much. There's a lot. I always when I'm asked things like that, I always say there's a lot of great creative marketing campaigns in the medical device world. But as far as real innovation that improves surgeons' lives and improve patients' lives, I would say, honestly, not so much. Like, I don't consider a slight variation in a screw thread pitch as innovation necessarily.
Yes.
But the marketing campaigns would suggest it is. And right. A slightly different type of rotator cuff anchor. That doesn't really excite me.
Mm-hmm.
But the advent of robotics and things like that, I mean, there's a lot of really cool, unique stuff going on. But I kind of roll my eyes at a lot of stuff that's called innovation. Like the trick is making stuff simpler, right?
Yeah.
And that's why people liked my device, because you look at it once and you can figure out it's super, super intuitive and simple.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. I went and looked at the website for Hunter Medical, and yeah. I was actually astonished by the simplicity of the device. I was expecting something a little different. I mean, as the chief medical officer, I brought in robotic systems and those kinds of things with all the articulations. And so when I saw yours, I mean, it just seemed like a very elegant design because of its simplicity.
Yeah, that's the trick. When I started sketching, the more I sketched, the more complicated I got. So I went through a bunch of revolutions, but that's the trick.
Yeah.
Making it simple. So much stuff in medical device world honestly seems to be just kind of over-engineered.
Mm-hmm.
I've also made the comment a couple of things to you. I can tell when I go in a case and open up some new product that came along that they had way too many engineers working on it. Right? Each one of them had to put their little signature feature on one specific component of it. So going on my journey, you do learn little things like that, because I've been in a room where two or three engineers were insisting that we do something this way or that way. And I end up doing I really just worked with, I guess, two different engineers kind of at two different times. And they took my design and made it functional and more highly functional, more easily manufacturable. But yeah, mine is ridiculously simple, I think. It's not real. You look at it, it's not real sexy and it doesn't look real complicated, but it's just so simple and nice and efficient. And the staff loves it because they can all assemble it.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to clean. It's stainless steel, so the system will last theoretically forever. But it's got these field kits that are disposable field kits that are patient protector pads that go with it that mm-hmm. really enhance the functionality of it.
Well, it's an amazing device, and I'll put a link in the show notes below for people who want to go to your website. I'm also going to see if we can add an image in here in the video for people to look at as you're talking. We'll kind of get an overlay in here. So okay. I think that'll be interesting. One of the questions that I just thought of, actually, do you have some memorable feedback that you've gotten from orthopedic surgeons as they started trying your device that are especially memorable or were maybe even very impactful for you?
It's interesting. Several. The one that comes to mind, there was an older gentleman, maybe in his 70s, I think, a retired orthopedic surgeon. I think I was at maybe the American Academy of Orthopedics meeting out on the West Coast someplace. I don't know, maybe San Diego or Seattle. I forget.
Mm-hmm.
And he came walking up with one of his friends that was a device company executive.
Mm.
And he came up and started looking at it. And he just said, well, why did you do this and do this? Back when I was training, we just used a couple of pillows and it worked out just fine. I'm like, well, we don't use pillows anymore. And that was all I could say to that. And anyway, he started talking about his old glory days back in the OR, and I thought this, you know, it was just kind of interesting how he didn't even get the concept of, well, it's, mm-hmm. Then he went on to say, well, I said, this saves me about 45 minutes every time I do a bad elbow case, because I don't have to flip them lateral. They move over to the table. One particular instance that came to mind, there was an academic surgeon at University C. David, and he was a trauma guy. And this was at a California meeting of the, I think it was the Hand Society, actually. And I guess he had heard about it, maybe the device, maybe had some friends that used it. I don't know. So he came over and of course, like most surgeons, we're all experts, right? If this was that great idea, I would have thought of it. You get a lot of that at the orthopedic conferences. You just got to kind of put on your sales rep hat and go with it.
Yeah.
But anyway, this guy said, oh God, what did he say? He said, well, why did you do this? Why do you even worry about doing an elbow fracture supine? Why would you do that? I said, well, it saves me like 45 or 50 minutes of positioning time, and I got better patient airway access. And he looked at me and said, well, hell, Lee, it's not my 45 minutes. I don't care how long it takes for the nurses to set the patient up. And I was like, oh, okay. All right. Thanks for dropping by. You know, what do you say to that?
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, there are a few of those. It is interesting. And everybody, a lot of people that stop by is when you're at the trade booth and you're selling your own product. Most everybody's well-intentioned, but you always have somebody that comes up and wants to pick at it. Oh, I would have done this or I would have done that. It still goes back to the same thing that a lot of people think we're for that good an idea, I would have thought of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but really I will tell you, after doing a few trade shows, like we did one a year for about 7 or 8 years, I will tell you, I have a much greater respect for the medical device rep and the booth man or lady who sits there, feels the questions, is polite to everybody, even those that don't deserve to be polite to. I have a much greater respect. It's a lot easier to be on the surgeon side and the physician side than it is the salesperson side.
Yes. Yeah. It's got to be a very challenging job.
I had one person help me sometimes, and we just staffed the booth all day long, and those booths got pretty old. But really, it was necessary to get the word out, and most everybody was super kind and interested in what you're doing, and it was, and that part of it was really funny. It's always cool to talk about, hey, this is, I created this, whatever. I think you'll really like it. Just give it a try.
So the product is out there now. It's being marketed kind of for you by a large company that's pretty well known. You mentioned when you started out that you were kind of committing a morning a week to developing the product. What does your schedule look like today with the company's growth, and obviously you're still in practice?
Yes, sir. When I first started out with the idea, I didn't take any time off at all. I just worked on the evenings. But then in 14, when I formed the company and we started cutting metal, I started taking a day a week off a month, like on second Thursday. And I'd work some at nights, so I'd work some in the day, but I kept my full surgery schedule and my same share of ER call.
Okay.
So that went on for a while. And then as we started ramping up, I did start taking a day a week off, Thursdays off, for the last couple of years before I sold the IP.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I sold the IP back in 22, they're doing the marketing, they're doing the selling of it. I'm the consultant. I still take a half day off, but other than occasional conference calls, cadaver labs, and things like that, there's not a whole lot of demands, if you will, on me right now. The company kind of took that away. And I'm working on some other things through the company, but I'm still a full-time surgeon.
Okay. So you're still taking a full surgical schedule, basically, and taking an equal share of call in your group?
Yes, I take a little bit less than the other docs. Some of the younger physicians, they want to take a little bit more call because they get a little bit of a stipend from the hospital and they get to bill for any cases they do or whatnot. So they're much more interested in a call than I am, but I still take a little bit.
What is involved in the consulting? You mentioned you do some cadaver labs. I assume that they're bringing other surgeons in to learn how to use the device in a cadaver lab situation. Do you travel to other hospitals to actually be present in the OR with actual patients?
No, there was one case where one instance about a year ago where a surgeon in the Nashville area wanted to trial the device And I'm a good friend of the distributor for the company here in Middle Tennessee. And he asked me if I would stick my head in because it was a friend of mine who was trialing it. Okay. Just to make sure super smoothly, but not usually. Usually the company flies me to point A. We do a cadaver lab and we look at some other stuff that they're looking at as far as tech goes. And they run marketing campaigns by me and things of that nature.
Okay. So now that you've sold the IP for this and you have a company that's marketing and doing the sales, you're kind of in a consultant role. You still have Hunter Medical LLC. What is your vision for Hunter Medical LLC?
It's kind of like it's kind of an device generator side company. So I've got five or six concept products that I'm working on. But the one that I'm actually going to bring to market later this year is this extremely useful little device for in-office trigger fingers and trigger thumb releases.
Okay.
And basically the concept is there's lots and lots of trigger fingers and trigger digits in the U.S., about 2 million are surgical releases each year.
Mm-hmm.
And right now there's kind of two ways to do it. One is in an OR setting, whether it's in a procedure room in your office with overhead lights and some sterile drapes and things like that, or it's in a hospital, or it's in a formal surgery center. But you're either making a small incision and looking at the tendon sheath and releasing it, or you're trying to do it free-handed with a needle percutaneously. So I've done lots and lots of trigger fingers over the years, and I always wanted to transfer that into office because it's cheaper for the patient, it's less cumbersome for them, it's easier. So I developed this little device that it's a very limited incision around 4 to 5 millimeters, and it's basically a glorified needle guide that I use right now.
Okay.
And I've actually just did my 200th patient today. So I did the whole thing. It was a similar process. I made some 3D printing prototype models. I did a bunch of cadaver labs that the company that I have a relationship with gave me. And I worked with it for a while. And it took me about a year to really hone that design to where it's slick and easy and works really, really well. And once you get the patient anesthetized in the room, it takes about a minute.
Wow.
With just overhead lighting and a hand table and a little cheap sterile tray and my device.
Now, is the device reusable? I mean, do you autoclave it, or is it a one-time, one-use type of device?
Well, the device as we have it right now is autoclavable and reusable. Okay. They're stainless steel, and I've got some what I call prototypes, but they're the devices I'm using. But the one mm-hmm. the device we're taking to market later this year, or someone's taking to market, will be disposable. It'll come in a peel pack with like a plastic handle and a stainless steel cannula with a self-contained little cutting apparatus that the surgeon can deploy and retract throughout the procedure. And keep in mind, the surgical area is only like a centimeter long, right?
Yeah.
Little area. But it's the quickest, safest, really best way to do a trigger finger that I've seen.
Interesting.
And I'm still refining it a little bit, but it's great. I love it. And I could teach you how to do one, Norm, a trigger finger release in the office in just a few minutes.
I was going to ask you if it was going to open up, because I know there are different proceduralists besides orthopedic surgeons and hand surgeons that are doing trigger fingers. I didn't know if this was going to be marketed to a broader group or if you're just focused on hand surgeons and orthopedic surgeons?
Probably hand. About 10% of us are plastic surgeons, the 90% orthopedics. But right now, yeah, just the hand surgeon crew.
Okay.
But what the whole push is to take trigger finger surgery largely out of the OR where it really doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
Because that's a lot of expense and a lot of effort to release a trigger finger.
Right.
When you're in the office, the patient can drive themselves there, drive themselves home. They don't have to strip down of their underwear. They don't have to be NPO.
Mm-hmm.
They get skin glue and a little Band-Aid. We follow them up. We make a 3-week post-op appointment, and about 1 out of 10 shows up for me to look at it. And you don't even, the other 90% do call back, because if they don't show up, we call them and ask them,
yeah,
how are you doing? But yeah, that's what we're going to do. We're going to make it where it's done in the office. You can use ultrasound, you cannot use ultrasound, but it's incredibly safe and incredibly effective. So that's the next thing that's coming along in the pipe.
And I assume, again, that this is a device that you've already patented as you've moved it through the development phases.
Yeah, we've had three. Well, the patents have been filed for about a year and a half.
So okay.
They won't be examined maybe for another 6 months.
Hmm. Okay.
And I did one, I filed a European, there's a common European country patent application called the PCT, patent corporation treaty or whatever it is, because there's a European company that is giving a look. So I filed a patent to kind of hold a placeholder for those companies, for those countries rather. But again, that'll be another year before it's reviewed. But I feel certain that they'll be granted.
Is it easier to go to market in a foreign country compared to the U.S. because of regulatory issues or other barriers?
Yeah, I think it's probably quite a bit more difficult. 60% of the medical device business in the world is the United States. Mm-hmm. So the rest of the world combined is 40%. And Europe is probably maybe half of that 40%. I'm not really sure about the statistics on that. So I never filed for international patents with my arm positioner. Mm-hmm. I think the company that I sold it to has, but I did not, because it was, you have to file a patent application fee for each country.
Oh, I see.
You have to have a patent attorney that's familiar with that country's patent processes. And you can, it just seemed like there was not enough meat on the bone, if you will.
Yeah.
It's really not worth my while.
So you developed this device for the trigger fingers. You mentioned you had several other devices that you're working on. So it sounds like Hunter Medical is kind of a little bit of an incubator type of company for you that's allowing you to kind of develop some prototypes and then reach out to other companies that might be interested in purchasing the IP and marketing it in the way that your positioning device was picked up.
Yeah, it's interesting, Norm. Once you have some, most 90-some-odd% of medical device companies fail, right? It's just particularly startups, right? That's the number. But if you win, if you get a win and you meet some connections through the industry, I can actually call people and get them to return my call or get a conversation, right? Because it took me years to get that first meaningful conversation with my other product. But now everything's a little bit easier. And frankly, it's a hell of a lot more fun after you have a win or two and you can take a few more vacations and not worry about it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it is. You're right. That's pretty much what I would call it. It's kind of a cool side gig incubator company.
So do you see this, your interest and your success in medical device, do you see it impacting your plans in terms of when you're going to retire from clinical medicine?
Not necessarily. I really love what I do. I think it's really the greatest job I can ever imagine having, frankly. So I'll stay in it for a while. I've got probably somewhere between 5 and 10 more years where I'll do the full-time surgeon gig. And then if I can do some medical device design stuff with a couple of companies that I've worked with in the past, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
But my model is what I'll probably go forward with. So I'll probably sell the IP that I create, but not necessarily sell the company per se. Okay. That's the first deal I had and it worked pretty well. And it's really nice to kind of watch something grow and sell it and then kind of bring something else along beside it. It's actually been a very painful experience and humbling experience at times, but overall you learn a lot in the process and it's been really rewarding.
You mentioned that you had a kind of a minor investor. Did you grow this company basically and through investment with your own money, just bootstrapping it? Or did you have an equity partner or investors with you?
That's a great question. So again, that's one of those things where I was fortunate. My device was not real and my concept was not real high tech. It was super low tech, not expensive. So I just took out a loan and bootstrapped it all. And for a period of time from around 2014 until around 2018, we took off pretty quick and then we kind of stagnated. And I had a company that had some very small company in the area that had some basic consulting healthcare experiences where they'd done kind of similar things with maybe not orthopedic devices, but some other healthcare devices where they had successful exits. So they threw in some sweat and equity for capital with, I think it was a 30% equity stake with their sweat capital. And they, did a marketing campaign on their own, and we ran with that. We actually tried to build a distributor network independent across the country, and they did all that. And at the end of the day, that was a failure because we couldn't find consistent, reliable device sales reps. And it was just too burdensome for me to try to train them all, frankly.
Okay.
So they got kind of disenchanted. So we just kind of parted ways, and I kept the company. And that's when I started working on a wrist tower. And when I popped that on, where everything fits in one little autoclavable tray, then things really started to happen. But I was kind of stupid and thought, hell, I can do all this myself. So I went ahead and did it. It just kind of happened to work out.
And I, if you're not comfortable answering this question, that's okay. But I'm just kind of wondering, since you formed the company in 2014 until now, what sort of financial benefit has accrued to you? Are you still recouping that investment cost from the loan? Have you turned the corner on the company?
So we haven't. When I sold the device, I paid off all the debt.
Okay.
And I sold that product line. So now I'm on a royalty stream. Basically, the deal I struck is, in general terms, it was an intellectual property sale of these specific patents and these specific trademarks. And there was a consulting agreement hitched to it. So okay. I signed a 5-year consulting agreement with them. And then the terms of that, the kind of the scope of that is defined in the contract.
Okay.
And then it was an IP royalty deal for basically the lifetime of the most recently issued patent.
Right.
Basically, is how that works.
And the lifetime of a patent is?
These were, I think when we signed, I think the most recently issued one was 10 years.
Okay.
It varies a little bit.
Okay.
But when mine were issued, they were 10 years. And I believe this next round, the good issues that gets issued would also be 10 years.
Okay. So you and I both went to Pemba a year apart. I was in 2008. You started in 2009. I think most people watching the show are going to know that it's a 1-year program. But was your interest in medical device development, was that the reason that you went to the MBA program or got an MBA, or was your career on a different trajectory at that point?
Like so many, I feel like so many people of kind of our generation, Norm, med school and residencies trained us to be really good physicians, but they didn't train us anything about business. At least that was my experience. So when I started, I always thought in the back of my head that I'd enjoy the process, the knowledge of getting an MBA.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I graduated from residency and fellowship, I just went to work like everybody else. And I turn around and 8 or 10 years go by and I'm older and the kids are growing up. And I thought, well, I'm just going to do it. But I went because I knew I was going to form this medical device company. And I thought, frankly, I'd have my lunch eaten if I didn't really learn more formal business strategy, acumen, social business skills, how to get a conversation, how to handle a conversation once you get it. Mm-hmm. How to manage people and the Pemba program really helped me with that. It helped me, I guess, of one of the many things that helped me. It helped me with kind of self-awareness, which I was trained as a surgeon, so we oftentimes don't have much of that. So it really helped me with people management and listen more than you speak and acknowledge and learn from your mistakes, things like that. It almost like the softer side of it maybe mm-hmm. helped me more than the spreadsheet business plan side of it. But yes, for me, I did it because I knew I was going to form a medical device company, and I felt I had a lot to learn before I did that.
Besides the soft side skills that you picked up there, did you tailor the MBA working with the team there to really give you specific knowledge regarding the entrepreneurial side of your plans or the medical device side of your plans?
Only in the sense that my OAP, I'm assuming mm-hmm. they still do that, this organization action project, that was about my medical device. And so that I really explored that and the SWOT analysis and the pros and cons and finance and capital budget, what will I need? That really helped me for everything from the marketing strategy, how I actually market, because you can spend however much you want to spend on a marketing campaign, but I ended up doing mine all basically guerrilla marketing, what I would call marketing.
Okay.
So I guess in a way I did. I took the same workload as everyone else, but my OIP was my medical device.
Do you remember who your OIP advisor was?
Who was it? I think it was the program director at the time. I think it was Michael Stahl.
Mike Stahl? Okay.
I think so.
Yeah,
in fact,
I wondered.
I'm pretty sure it was.
I wondered whether they would have chosen someone from the marketing side, but Mike certainly had a great breadth of business knowledge, and I can see that he would have been a great advisor for your OAP.
Oh, he was terrific. Sometimes you need some people who will tell you what you don't want to, what you're kind of scared to hear, right?
Yeah.
Lee, this may bomb completely. You may lose everything. I'm like, well, yeah, okay, yeah. Well, let's try to make sure that doesn't happen. But Mike was terrific. I had a lot of respect for him. He helped me a lot.
Good. So I like to ask all of the Pemba alums that come on as guests to just kind of think back and what was the one thing that you enjoyed the most about the Pemba program?
For me, really, I think it was the conversations that you have with your peers and learning a little bit about kind of what is going on and how these really smart, obviously motivated people view their current situation and the status of healthcare and where they want to see it go.
Okay.
It's just so you have to have the courage. It's always easy to go complain about how things are, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But most of us that went to Pemba had the courage and enough, whatever capital to try to improve ourselves and our skills so we could actually make healthcare better for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Me talking to the rheumatologist and the urologist, the internal medicine physician, the ER doc, the pulmonologist. It was just very rewarding, those relationships, and they really helped me a lot also.
Great. Well, Lee, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the show tonight. This has been fun, number one. I've really enjoyed it, but I learned a lot, and I think the physicians that listen to this are going to learn a great deal as well. So thank you for taking time out of your day to come on the show.
Thank you, Norm. Hey, I really appreciate you having me.
Yeah. Thanks again. We'll talk later.
All right. Thank you, Norm. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today for this episode of Pemba On Demand. I enjoyed having Lee share his passion for medical device development and commercializing his inventions. His story was fascinating, and I really enjoyed hearing about his journey and his success in this area. I hope you enjoyed his journey also, and that you learned and benefited from his experience. I found his experience and journey fascinating. Hearing about his newest invention for improving trigger finger surgery was also very fascinating. I appreciated him sharing his perspectives of the value of the MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville also. Thanks again for joining us.
Pemba On Demand is released biweekly every other Thursday and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.